Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, 100,000 Iraqis march in Baghdad demanding direct elections. Will the United Nations hear their plea?
And it's downright frigid in Iowa. So who's likely to come out to caucus?
They are often party workers, elected officials, people who feel passionately about being Democrats.
Also, plastic surgery. One woman describes the seduction of the plastic surgeon.
They'll often compliment the women, tell them how good-looking they are. And if they just had this bit altered, then they would be perfect-looking. So you're being complimented and shamed at the same time, but they're the very people who can rescue you from the shameful feature.
These stories and more are coming up here and now.
News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Democratic presidential contenders are in the home stretch in Iowa, where tonight's caucuses will provide the first real test of the presidential campaign. NPR's David Wellness says the race is very tight.
After months when it appeared former Vermont Governor Howard Dean was poised to win this first big contest of the presidential race, the candidate who's done best in very recent polls is Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, followed closely by North Carolina Senator John Edwards. Dean ranks third and Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt fourth, while the only other contender in Iowa tonight, Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, shows scant support. But those polls reflect preferences among a group of voters whose loyalties can easily shift at the caucuses. And the real key to victory is getting supporters to actually attend the caucuses. With massive get-out-the-vote efforts underway by rival campaigns, record attendance is expected despite bitterly cold weather at the nearly 2,000 caucuses being held. David Wellner, NPR News, Des Moines.
The U.S. Administrator for Iraq, Paul Bremer, has been meeting with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan at the United Nations today as the Bush administration pushes for a return of U.N. staff members who were withdrawn from Iraq after two bombings last year. But Annan says Iraq is still too dangerous for now. Just yesterday, more than 30 people were killed in a suicide bombing outside the main U.S. headquarters in Baghdad. South Korea's president is downplaying concerns about an agreement with the U.S. to pull American troops out of Seoul. Some lawmakers there are worried about the move. The BBC's Charles Scanlon has more from Seoul.
President Noh told political allies there was nothing to worry about. He said the government had done its best in negotiations with the United States, and it was anachronistic to think U.S. troops were still needed in the capital. Conservatives, however, say the move leaves Seoul dangerously vulnerable to North Korean aggression. The United States agreed to relocate the 7,000 troops to safer positions further south within 3 years. It follows a recent upsurge of anti-American sentiment in the country and is part of a broader repositioning of American troops in the region. 15,000 frontline troops are also to be pulled south, out of range of North Korean artillery. The U.S. says it will put more emphasis on long-range precision weapons.
The BBC's Charles Scanlon reporting. Negotiators are trying to talk two Arizona prison inmates into giving up the guards they've been holding hostage since the weekend. The guards, one man, one woman, were allowed to speak with officials today to assure them that they're in good condition. The prison, west of Phoenix, houses more than 4,000 inmates. On this Martin Luther King Day, the widow of the slain civil rights leader is calling on Americans to remember what unites them, not the political divisions of an election year. Ms. Coretta Scott King spoke at the church in Atlanta where Dr. King was pastor. The stock market is closed today. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, with Wall Street on holiday, European stocks hit a new 16-month high today, and the dollar has held on to its recent gains against the euro ahead of a meeting of European finance ministers this week. When trading resumes on Wall Street tomorrow, investors will be hoping to add to last week's gains. NPR's Dave Mattingly has more.
The Dow Jones Industrials ended last week at 10,600, the Dow's highest close in a year. The Dow finished Friday with a gain of nearly 47 points, driven in part by a strong earnings report from General Electric. For the week, the Dow was up nearly 1.5%. The Nasdaq closed last week at its highest level in 2.5 years at 2,140. The Nasdaq gained more than 31 points on Friday, helping to boost the Nasdaq's weekly gain to more than 2.5%. Among the items investors will have to pore over this week, IBM's weekend announcement that it plans to add 15,000 jobs worldwide, new figures due out on housing construction, and the Conference Board's latest index of leading economic indicators. Wall Street will also be watching President Bush's State of the Union address tomorrow night and his assessment of the nation's economic recovery. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
McDonald's has decided not to renew its endorsement agreement with NBA star Kobe Bryant. The fast food firm said only that Bryant's 3-year deal expired last month and would be inappropriate to speculate about any future relationship. Bryant's image has been tarnished since a woman accused him of sexual assault last year. Bryant has denied that allegation. Another company, Ferraro of Italy, earlier chose not to renew its endorsement deal with Bryant. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today in central Baghdad, up to 100,000 Iraqi Shiites chanting yes to elections, no to occupation, demanded a one-man, one-vote representative government. Today's peaceful protest comes as Paul Bremer, U.S. administrator in Iraq, and members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council meet in New York with Secretary General Kofi Annan to ask for help in delaying elections now scheduled to take place next spring. Linda Vasula is a regular contributor to NPR from the United Nations. She joins us on the line. Hello.
Hello, Robin.
Linda, let's remind people what the Iraqis are protesting. The U.S. officials want provincial elections, sort of regional caucuses. It's funny, we note that only one state in the U.S. practices this. They're doing it today, and many Iraqis don't even understand the process.
Well, I think a lot of people don't understand it here as well. But I think my understanding is that the attempt is to go forward with some kind of plan that would not involve direct elections, because we have to remember that Iraq is a country that doesn't even have a recent census. And worst of all, they've never really had legitimate elections, so there is not an accurate roster of voter registration rolls. So the feeling is that, my understanding is that over the to conduct some kind, you know, to a process to get some kind of provisional government in place by July 1st, it wouldn't be fair to hold elections, and it'd be virtually impossible to do that in that short time span.
So now, as we said, Paul Bremer comes to make the U.S. case to the U.N. What is Kofi Annan expected to say?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because last month, in late December, one of the Shiite members of the Iraqi Governing Council wrote a letter to Secretary General Kofi Annan, complaining about the caucuses and basically saying that direct elections would be preferable. And what Annan said back in his letter was that he thought there really was not enough time to conduct fair and free elections in Iraq between now and July 1st. However, what he also said was that he was in favor of a more inclusive and transparent process in getting to that transitional government. I think the United States would like Kofi Annan to come out clearly and unequivocally against direct elections. But diplomacy and the UN being what it is, we're probably more likely to see no real quick action today. Instead, there's been talk that perhaps the UN would set up a small team that might even go to Iraq, look into the issue of holding direct elections, you know, for the legislature that would lead to the appointment of a transitional government by July 1st. And knowing that most professionals or election professionals feel that it's really not feasible to have direct direct elections, you know, in this short time period, that perhaps they might be able to coax the Shiites into a compromise.
And particularly Ayatollah Sistani, who is the leading cleric of the Shiite Muslims, and he has called for direct elections.
Exactly. But there's this sense in the corridors here that perhaps he and his followers would maybe move towards a compromise if indeed the UN said that those direct elections would not be democratic.
One last quick question, Linda. Is there any thought that yesterday's truck bomb outside the main gate to the American forces headquarters was in any way connected to today's meeting?
I haven't heard of any direct connection, but we do know that a great sensitivity here at the United Nations is the fact that the UN headquarters in Baghdad was bombed on August 19th and again soon after. And Secretary General Kofi Annan has made it clear that he will not return UN staff to Iraq unless security can be guaranteed. So I would think that, you know, given what happened yesterday, it's not helping the case.
Linda, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Linda Fasulo, United Nations correspondent for NBC News and a regular contributor to NPR.
Few things cause millions of Pakistanis more pride than their country's nuclear bomb. So it's walking a political high wire, many analysts say, for Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf to have now detained 8 nuclear scientists from the country's top weapons lab. They're being questioned about transfers of nuclear technology to Iran in the late 80s and early 90s. John Lancaster of The Washington Post joins us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. John, welcome.
Thank you.
John, thanks for joining us. These detentions resulted from what? New information?
Well, we're not entirely sure. It's part of an ongoing investigation that, as you may know, was triggered by information provided to Pakistan by the UN International Atomic Energy Agency, which during inspections of Iranian nuclear facilities found some evidence that Pakistani scientists may have collaborated in helping Iran with its nuclear program. This information was brought to the attention of Pakistani authorities several months ago, and they've been conducting an investigation.
Why would Pakistan help Iran with its nuclear program?
Well, the official explanation is that Pakistan didn't, at least not on any official level. The official explanation is that if there were any kind of collaboration in between Pakistani scientists and Iranian nuclear weapons designers, that it was done so without authorization. And there have been suggestions from Pakistani officials that there may have been scientists who are essentially doing this for money. But they still haven't acknowledged that any technology transfer actually took place.
Yeah. John, knowing what you know about Pakistan and how things work there, if these scientists had gone to Iran and shared nuclear technology, nuclear know-how somehow, wouldn't the government have known that?
Well, there are certainly plenty of analysts and experts, both in Washington and in Pakistan, who would say that the answer to that is yes. That it's hard to imagine that scientists would have sort of gone off freelancing in this way, given the tight control that the military has traditionally exerted over Pakistan's military program. It must be said that these transfers, these alleged transfers, occurred before President General Musharraf seized power in a coup in 1999. So at least as far as the Iranian case is concerned, we're talking about stuff that happened, you know, a decade ago. In the case of North Korea and Libya, it's more problematic for President Musharraf because some of those transfers are alleged to have occurred more recently, including during the time when he was Army Chief of Staff, a position that he continues to hold.
What do you think is going to happen here? Do you think the detentions will go on for a while and then they'll be released and maybe that will bring it all to an end? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think anyone knows. I mean, certainly the government seems to have telegraphed that perhaps it's prepared to prosecute some individual scientists. But it has not indicated that in the case of A.Q. Khan, the former lab director, and I think probably there's a lot of high level discussion going on right now in the Pakistani government about just how far they can push this.
John Lancaster of The Washington Post joined us from Islamabad, Pakistan. John, thanks very much.
You're most welcome.
Tonight, Iowans will gather promptly at 6:30 in kitchens and living rooms across the state to caucus. We'll have a report from Iowa later in the program, but now, four Democratic contenders, Gephardt, Dean, Edwards, and Kerry, are said to be in a dead heat there. But polling is tough in Iowa. Only 3% of the state's qualified voters even attended the 2,000 Democratic caucuses. About double are expected this year. But who are they? Joining us on the line is Stephen Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. And Professor Schmidt, can you break down caucus voters demographically?
They are often party workers, elected officials, people who feel passionately about being Democrats and who see this not as some sort of an obligation, but actually as something that they love and that they feel is very important.
And so how do they reflect the state? Who's left out?
Well, I think people who have a casual interest are left out. Young people are left out. A lot of people who work during those hours of 6:30 until 10 o'clock at night on caucus night and can't get off work. People who have maybe children at home or family obligations and they can't leave for a couple or 3 hours are left out.
And do we understand that most of these people who, as you said, are more activist, are they more metropolitan as well?
No, that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. I mean, rural Iowans have a great interest in the caucuses, and there are sort of blocks of people who turn out. I mean, rural active people, farmers and others who really feel passionately about the roots and history of the Democratic Party, they go as well. Organized labor is a little bit overrepresented because it is such a highly organized community mm-hmm. that they tend to turn out people better on caucus night.
And they have a candidate that they're backing this year in Dick Gephardt. But speaking of where Iowans live, we understand 4 in 10 Iowans live in a rural area, and that's double the national average. So I'm wondering, how does the turnout in Iowa reflect the national population? I'm thinking the pictures that I'm seeing from Iowa, I rarely see a minority face.
In Iowa, we try to have very targeted minority participation, and we recruit Latinos and African Americans in particular. But it is true that, like a lot of states that don't have large minority populations, that element is underrepresented.
And with some of the current issues, I'm thinking of President Bush's proposed immigration policy, for instance. Of the 1.4 million immigrants who came to the U.S. in 2002, only 7,000 settled in Iowa. That's about a half of 1%. So does the turnout in Iowa reflect the concern or maybe lack of concern about national issues?
No, not at all, because that number that you mentioned in a state with a small population like Iowa actually has more impact than it would in California, where they don't even notice more immigrants coming. I know for a fact that there are going to be resolutions introduced in the caucuses and that people are, regarding immigration, that people are looking at the candidates' positions on these issues. Mm. The truth of the matter, however, is that I think that if these campaigns began in California or Massachusetts, it would not necessarily be a different bunch of people offering themselves as president.
Well, Professor Schmidt, one last question. Iowans famously greeted Professor Harold Hill in The Music Man when he got off the train with a degree of coldness, the song Iowa Stubborn. And I'm wondering, how are Iowans there feeling about all the outsiders who have poured into the state, the Dean supporters in their orange hats and the unions?
We love visitors, and we're very friendly people. We never, I think, are rude to anybody. That's also kind of Iowa nice, like Minnesota. But the truth of the matter is we are only concerned that outsiders who are not Iowa residents are going to try to same-day register at the caucuses and try to skew the outcome. And there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of new people in a caucus who are not people haven't seen around before. And I think that's the only concern about the hordes of people that are coming in to support candidates. Mm.
Stephen Schmidt, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Stephen Schmidt is a professor of political science at Iowa State University.
Here's an Iowa pie, a special chip on his shoulder, ready to be never been without that we recall. We can be cold as a falling thermometer in December if you ask about the weather in July.
Well, just ahead, we look at Americans' sometimes obsessive fascination with cosmetic surgery.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The death last week of 54-year-old novelist Olivia Goldsmith, author of The First Wives Club, has drawn attention again to the business of cosmetic surgery. Goldsmith, a self-proclaimed champion of older women, died after being given anesthesia before a facelift. Well, another author, Virginia Bloom, writes of the dangers of cosmetic surgery as well as the seduction in her new book, Flesh Wounds, The Culture of Cosmetic Surgery. Since 1997, plastic surgeries in the U.S. have increased 228%. And while Bloom notes that thousands of women and men have been helped by surgeries, she says the increase also points to a dangerous and addictive obsession with celebrity. Virginia Bloom's book begins with a candid discussion of her own personal experiences. She joins us on the line from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Hello, Virginia.
Hi, Robin.
Well, your story does begin with you, with your nose.
It does. I was the daughter of ethnically assimilative Jewish parents, and that was a pretty standard discussion of the time. Certainly lots of Jewish women in my age group remember having the discussion with their parents. And sometimes parents say, we really think you should have your nose done. Sometimes they just say, oh, you know, if you want to have it done, we wouldn't object.
Which sort of implies
yes, you
need to have it done.
Right.
Well, tell us
it's
more.
It's the discussion.
It's the discussion in some Jewish families. We want to say we know this isn't the experience of all young Jewish women by any means. But tell us more about your experience 30 years ago. I'm looking at a picture of you on your book jacket. You are a beautiful woman.
Thank you.
And I'm looking at your nose. Which I bet people do a lot more now.
Yes, that's unfortunately a consequence of this, yes. Yeah.
What would you say it was changed? What happened?
I've had hap surgery several times, so the nose you're seeing is a corrected, post-secondary surgery nose.
Was it made slimmer?
It was made slimmer. It was made Roman. It was twisted to one side. Too much cartilage was removed. There was, like, damage, internal damage as well.
What happened to you when, you know, there's this great moment of unveiling, there's this expectation, and in your case, there's mixed emotions about even doing it. What does that do to you?
Well, it made me kind of angry. I should say that. But here's the thing. I didn't really know how bad my nose was for about a year until all the swelling had gone down and I could see the dents and I could see that it was kind of twisted. And in part, I ignored it. I would mainly notice it in pictures. And so ultimately, I thought, this is not okay. This was something that was done to me. You know, I didn't come into the world this way. I can have this changed. And once you're surgical, you're surgical. It's on your horizon that you could be in for more surgeries. If it goes wrong, you're in for more surgeries. And if it goes right, you may be in for more surgeries because you want to recuperate that good feeling.
You talked about the connection between your mother's desire to assimilate in the culture through you, and you apply it to other cultures. I mean, what is it? The double eyelid surgery is now being...
Yes.
Tell us about that in the Asian community.
Yes, in the Asian American community, very similar to the experience of middle-class Jewish women, many young Asian American women are undergoing double-lid surgery to make their eyes more Caucasian.
And parents are giving it as graduation presents.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Right.
But that sounds more like trying to make the WASP connection, if you will, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant connection. What is the Hollywood connection? What's the connection to celebrity?
The history of celebrity culture is one of imitation. For many years, audiences have imitated the clothing styles, the makeup, the manners of speaking, and so forth, but neither knew nor had access to the body-enhancing surgeries of celebrities.
And yet, I'm thinking that also we're seeing more and more horrendously botched surgeries with very famous, beautiful actresses.
I know we are, and I don't know why that doesn't scare us off. It's interesting. We're very intrigued about them. But I think that most interesting is that as a culture, we identify with people whose job in life is to transform, is to go from one role to another.
And, of course, you know, this is it sounds predictable, but we yearn for a woman who will allow herself to age gracefully on the screen so that everyone else can do it.
I know we do, but, I mean, actresses aren't. You know, actresses aren't responsible. I mean, I think when we see really overly surgical actresses, we're seeing the desperation. We're seeing the absolute incapacity of the body to measure up to ideal images. Hmm. I mean, if it's bad enough for the, you know, normal, ordinary people, non-celebrities who are trying to emulate these celluloid idols, consider the impossibility for the actress herself or the actor himself who can never measure up to their own screen image. Hmm. And I think we're seeing the disastrous results of that in their botched surgeries or their overdone surgeries.
And as you started to say, why are we looking to them anyway? Why are we putting that burden
right
on them to do it? You write about a great many things, but just tell us briefly about the surgeons. And it's a generalization, but you talk about the tie between plastic surgery and, you know, the celebrity world. Well, many of the surgeons are themselves the celebrities.
They are. If they want to be celebrities, I mean, if you want to be a Hollywood surgeon, you have to do that. You have to get publicists. You have to get agents.
How seductive is that?
You mean for the patient?
Yeah.
Very. I think very. I mean, one of the classic plastic surgeon moves that I've experienced and certainly other people have experienced is that they will often, and especially if there's a kind of heterosexual dynamic, if you've got a male surgeon, female patient, they'll often compliment the women, tell them how good-looking they are. And if they just had this bit altered, then they would be perfect-looking. Hmm. So you're being complimented and shamed at the same time, but they're the very people who can rescue you from the shameful feature.
Virginia, one last question before we let you go. You had the botched nose surgery.
Yes.
And then had several repairs of that. Do you kind of sometimes wish that you were Virginia Blum with a very wide nose?
I do. I do that, absolutely. I mean, I think at a certain point, I was hoping that some surgery would return my original nose to me.
Hmm. Well, Virginia Blum, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Virginia is Associate Professor of English at the University of Kentucky and author of the new book, Flesh Wounds, The Culture of Cosmetic Surgery.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the week ahead in politics and the mood of Democrats in Iowa.
Pundits are just running around here. It's crazy. And also, there's not a lot of love, you know, for Howard Dean.
And rediscovering two jazz saxophonists, one of whom is probably more well-known for his venture into pop music.
Curtis Amy appeared on a couple of Doors albums, and he takes what I think is maybe the single greatest tenor saxophone solo ever heard on a modern, in quotes, rock and roll record. He solos on the Doors tune called Touch Me.
These stories, coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Democrats in Iowa are just hours away from caucuses that could define the presidential race. The polls show a virtual four-way tie between Howard Dean, John Edwards, Dick Gephardt, and John Kerry. Pundits are looking to the weather forecast in Iowa to try and predict turnout. There's no snow expected today in the Hawkeye State, and a wind chill advisory issue this morning has been canceled. President Bush addresses the nation tomorrow night with his annual State of the Union message. He's expected to propose $120 million in new job training grants for community colleges. The economy has lost about 2.3 million jobs since he took office. That is the worst job creation record of any president since Herbert Hoover.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Memorials, parades, church services, and volunteer projects are going on across the country today in honor of slain civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In Atlanta this morning, his widow, Coretta Scott King, spoke at Dr. King's home church, calling for peace in the world and at home. There's word of a deadly attack by a U.S. military helicopter in Afghanistan, where a regional official describes the 11 victims as simple villagers. Four of them were children. The U.S. helicopter attacked a house in a village in southern Afghanistan, in an area where forces had earlier searched for Taliban fighters. U.S. and Iraqi officials are meeting at the U.N. today to discuss what role the world body should play in Iraq. Coalition officials want to see a quick return of U.N. staff members who were pulled out of Iraq after two bombings last year. But U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan says it is still too dangerous. Meanwhile, as many as 100,000 Iraqi Shiite Muslims marched in Baghdad today, calling for an elected government in Iraq and an end to occupation. China plans to begin testing an experimental SARS vaccine on humans, according to the official Chinese news agency. It says about 30 people have been volunteered as subjects to test the vaccine. The World Health Organization is urging China to share results of the upcoming trial with other countries. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The big winner in tonight's Iowa caucuses could be, drumroll please, uncommitted. Remember Jimmy Carter, who put the caucuses on the political map? He came in second to uncommitted in 1976. Well, the race in Iowa 2004 is too close to call, and the situation isn't very different across the country. 43% of registered voters polled by the New York Times last week said they'd pick President Bush, while 45% said they'd vote for the Democrat, which sets up an interesting week ahead in politics. Tomorrow, the president delivers his State of the Union address, and Congress returns from winter break. Joining us on the line are members of our D.C. roundtable. Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
And Andrea Stone covers Washington for USA Today, but today she's in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
And you've been hearing, Andrea, what you've been calling the ABD, the Anybody But Dean, other candidates ganging up on the front runner. At least that was last week. What about today?
Well, you know, the pundits are just running around here. It's crazy. And also been to some events and talked to regular people who actually will have a say in the caucuses tonight. And there's not a lot of love, you know, for Howard Dean. I mean, you know, there are definitely pockets in the big cities and the college towns here in Iowa. But, you know, he's kind of wearing on people. People out here think that he's too gaffe-prone.
Well, what about, this past weekend he flew to Georgia to visit with former President Jimmy Carter?
Right. There was a photo op there, and also we had a surprise appearance by Judy Steinberg Dean, Howard Dean's wife, who has been noticeably absent on the trail, and people were starting to talk about it.
And can you see any direct result of that?
Oh, well, you know, he did, in today's latest tracking poll, the Reuters-Zogby poll, Howard Dean seemed to come up a little bit. He's still behind John Kerry, but the free fall seemed to have stopped and reversed itself. And some people are interpreting her appearance here as sort of an act of desperation.
You know, she can't win because they begged her to come, and so as soon as she comes, knock her down again. But Bill, I'm wondering, what are you hearing in Washington? Are the Republicans, for instance, you know, they're in a tough place because they are not at the caucuses in the traditional way. And are they sort of sitting back and letting the Democrats sort of take the stage?
No, they're not sitting back at all. I mean, President Bush is very active, very busy raising money. And Republicans have sent plane loads of surrogates to Iowa. Former New York Mayor Giuliani is going to be there today. Ed Gillespie, a Republican strategist, is on the ground. Mary Matlin's on the ground. So they're out there getting their message out.
And I think President Bush's campaign, which hasn't really gotten a start yet, is going to, and I think you're going to be seeing a lot more of Vice President Cheney. He's going to come out from his undisclosed location, and he's going to start getting out there on the hustings. Mm.
And by the way, Andrea, in Iowa, are there any issues being discussed? I mean, besides people's wives, and John Kerry was embraced by a Vietnam veteran that he, John Kerry, saved.
Yeah, I was at that event. It was really unbelievable.
It seemed pretty emotional.
Yeah,
but,
really.
But is anybody talking about, you know, ethanol subsidies or...
Oh, you mean the issues? Yeah, people are talking. I think a big issue here has been the middle class tax cuts. John Kerry wants to keep them, and he's saying that Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt want to take them away. The war has not been as big an issue. It's kind of faded a little bit. I think one of the things you might be seeing in the polling is that the anger against Democrats like Dick Gephardt, John Kerry, who voted for the Iraq War resolution last year, starting to kind of fade away. Democrats here are saying, okay, let's just get over that. We need to find somebody who can beat George Bush. And if people are maybe not as angry as they were and more focused on November, that's not good for Howard Dean. Hmm.
Well, speaking of George Bush, Bill, in Washington, the president's going to be giving his State of the Union address tomorrow. He's been releasing some of the initiatives. He'll include money for job training, the mission, of course, to Mars, the undocumented workers policy. What else do you expect him to say tomorrow night?
You can look for this speech to have a lot of campaign themes and a lot of campaign issues in it. You addressed the immigration reform aspect of this. They rolled that out early. The reelection campaign desperately wants to get a good chunk of Hispanic voters. The jobs portion that he will talk about, he's proposing $120 million in grants through the Labor Department for job training for people who are out of work. That's a pretty big deal, and it's a pretty big issue for the president because in the Labor Department statistics that were released for December, job growth only grew by 1,000 jobs nationwide. So this is something that they're very mindful of and something they want to get out there and show that they're addressing these issues.
Well, Bill, what about hot-button issues like I'm thinking of same-sex marriage or private savings accounts for some of the federal retirement programs? Do you think he'll go out on a limb on any of these issues?
Any hot buttons, if the button's hot, I don't think they want to touch it.
And there's also a rule of thumb. This is a presidential election year. Congress doesn't get a lot done. I mean, I don't think immigration is going to come up this year. It's just too hot, like Bill said. So just sort of at the margins, they have a very big spending bill for the 2004 budget, which started October 1st. They still have not gotten that through. So they've got to get the spending bill passed in order to keep the government running. But much beyond that, I wouldn't look for it.
Yeah, I think what we're going to have at this speech are more themes than actual things that will get done. I think he wants to lay out there that he understands that the economy is the recovery is a jobless one, and that they're sensitive to that and they want to do something about it. I think they want to show or to remind people that they are very strong on defense and national security.
Well, Andrea, I'm not sure I want to leave it on that cheery note that with a divided Congress and an election year, nothing will get done. So, well, before we leave you in Iowa, can you just share with us one thing that strikes you about Iowans?
Yes, they are really well informed. The people who show up at these campaign events, they've done their homework, they've read the newspapers, they've been on the internet. And, you know, what struck me, I think this happened at least a couple of events, Kerry events that I was at. Kerry would ask the audience, do you know how many, you know, jobs have been created in the last quarter under the Bush administration? And in both times, people said, 1,000. And Kerry said, and he promised 250,000 and only 1,000. And I was just struck by the fact that people have the answers already. You know, they really take it seriously. You know, as much as people, including myself, you know, say, why does Iowa have all this power so early in the presidential process? You know, these people do take it seriously.
Bill, I'm reminded it's Martin Luther King Day. You were with President Bush when he went to Atlanta, right?
Yeah, he was greeted by hundreds of protesters who basically thought that his visit was a drive-by for a photo op, and their feelings were reinforced the next day when the president named Charles Pickering to a recessed federal judgeship appointment.
Very controversial appointment. People say that Pickering is a segregationist and some even say racist. But, well, boy, I tell you what, it sort of got buried by all the news out of Iowa.
Yes.
I think that's always the point about recessed appointments. They're done sort of in the night.
Andrea, Bill, thank you both.
Thank you.
Andrea Stone covers Washington for USA Today. Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. They're members of our D.C. Roundtable.
Still to come, two lesser-known sax maestros. Jazz critic James Isaacs joins us.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Today is the day we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who would have been 75 years old, a man now revered, which is exactly as it should be, our next guest believes, though he also wonders if the idolization of Dr. King can also somehow water down his passion. Joining us on the line is Religion and Islamic Studies Professor Ahmed Safi of Colgate University in New York State. Welcome, Professor.
Good to be with you.
And it's good to have you. Professor, as a student of and as someone who honors Dr. Martin Luther King, as so many of us do, what do you think of how Dr. King is celebrated now?
Well, I'm certainly also someone that has a great deal of love and appreciation for Dr. King. And at the same time, I can't help but wonder that if Martin himself would have been a bit uncomfortable at the idealization that is directed towards him, because I think he saw his own challenge really as engaging us, as challenging us, as getting us to strive for a higher ideal. And I think some of the adoration that we pour on Martin, in a way, gives us a bit of a safety valve. It gives us a distance from him, as if he is so great that we should adore him, not aspire to the same ideal that he does.
This great Christian preacher, toward the end of his life, began to sprinkle some of his sermons and speeches with words from Islamic spirituality.
After 1964, he starts speaking of the Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, universal brotherhood. And naming Muslims is a very powerful part, I think. The other thing that he does is that he incorporates poetry from Omar Khayyam, who's a well-known poet from the Islamic tradition, sometimes taken to be a Sufi. When he is speaking out in judgment of America, Martin says, and Omar is right, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation.
But there was also tension between Dr. King and some African Americans who'd adopted Islam, right?
That's right. There was tension between Martin and Malcolm. I think at times people tend to simplify things and make Martin into simply this paragon of love and Malcolm into simply this angry, rebellious kind of a voice. And I would urge people to realize that there's an anger to Martin as well, that there's frustration and pain in him as well.
You rather feel that Dr. King, in becoming an icon, becomes too one-dimensional?
I do. I think it's love for people to do on this day. I think this is maybe the greatest way of honoring him. So I urge people to go and read his speech, Beyond Vietnam, sometimes called A Time to Break Silence. This is the speech that he gave at the Riverside Church in New York City exactly a year before he was assassinated. And if people read this speech and they see how he speaks with love for America, but also sees America as being what he calls the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and as someone who's disappointed, profoundly disappointed, with American foreign policy.
Martin Luther King loved the United States as well?
I think he does. And, you know, when you see him speak out against America, or when you see him speak out against the white church establishment, he always says that he speaks out because he loves. And this is a disappointment that is rooted in love. And, again, looking at the world that we have today, some of us have to wonder, is it possible to love America and the ideals for which it stands and can stand for, and at the same time adopt a position of firm dissent, as Martin did?
Professor Omid Safi of Colgate University, a religion professor who specializes in Islam. Professor, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's Here and Now. Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Lester Young, giants of the jazz sax, who cast such long shadows, other brilliant sax players can be hard to see. But we're going to hear right now two great sax players you may not have heard about, with Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Two new CDs, one by Curtis Amy, the other by Joel Fromm. James, welcome.
How you doing, Bill?
I'm good. James, Curtis Amy. Not well known.
Not well known at all. Curtis Amy, born 1929, although some history books give the birth years 1927. He died in 2002. Curtis Amy's playing could be described as somewhere between soul jazz and hard bop. And as his career progressed, he got more into, I guess you could call it, early avant-garde.
And Curtis Amy has a couple of new CDs. He's got a box.
Yeah, it's a 3-CD set. The title is just Curtis Amy. It's on Mosaic's new Mosaic Select line. This is, as I said, 3 CDs, all of them originally recorded for Pacific Jazz Records in Los Angeles between 1960 and 1963. And over the course of these 3 CDs, we hear soul jazz, we hear hard bop, and we hear early avant-garde leanings from Curtis Amy. But what we hear most from him is the sound of the blues that informed almost everything he played, such as the one that we're going to hear. He wrote it. It was recorded in 1961. And notice the heraldic John Coltrane-esque entrance on this tune going into it.
Mm-hmm.
1961, Curtis Amy, Gone Into It. Nice sound.
Yeah, just conventional soul jazz dash blues line. Curtis Amy was quite facile at writing blues lines, such as the next one that we're going to hear, with a title that is very much of its time, recorded in 1960. The tune's title is One More Ham Hock, Please. Now,
okay.
On this tune, the organist is Paul Bryant. Jazz organ and tenor saxophone combos were very popular from the late 50s into the mid-1960s. And listen to the way that Curtis Amy wails the blues with Paul Bryant's organ chords behind him. One More Ham Hock, Please.
Curtis Amy in 1960, One More Ham Hock, Please. He was very much a part of the pop music scene that evolved out of the 60s, wasn't he?
Well, later on, very much so. Curtis Amy appeared on a couple of Doors albums, and he takes what I think is maybe the single greatest tenor saxophone solo ever heard on a modern, in quotes, rock and roll record. He solos on the Doors tune called Touch Me, and he also played on Carole King's trillion-selling album Tapestry. And before we finish here, there's one more thing I'd like to mention in connection with this Curtis Amy 3-CD set. It's the presence of one of jazz's great mystery men, trumpeter Dupree Bolton. Jazz is filled with mysterious characters who don't get to make very many records, but when they do, they create a tremendous impression, and then they're gone as quickly as they appeared. Dupree Bolton was part of Curtis Amy's masterpiece, the album called Katanga. Dupree Bolton's tone is so at once bright and painfully beautiful, and the way that he articulates his lines, his ideas. And this guy, this was his last record, as far as I know. Another reason for people to be interested in this 3-CD Curtis Amy set on Mosaic Select.
You Don't Know What Love Is, trumpeter Dupree Bolton, on sax player Curtis Amy's greatest album, James Isaacs tells us, Katanga, recorded in 1963. Just very briefly, what became of Curtis Amy?
Well, after Katanga, he went on the road with Ray Charles's band, and he was also, for a number of years, an executive for Ode Records.
Curtis Amy got a desk job?
Yeah.
Interesting. And passed away?
2002.
Well, very much still with us is the other featured sax player we're talking about today, Joel Fromm. Tell us about him.
Joel Fromm, originally from Wisconsin, but moved with his family to Hartford, Connecticut when he was about 15 years old. And it was in Hartford that he met a pianist who is among the most gifted of the younger generation on that instrument today, Brad Meldow. They were high school friends, and they learned jazz together as kids, you know.
Let's hear a bit of Joel Fromm.
Joel is a tenor and a soprano player, as was Curtis Amy, by the way. His sound is not anywhere near as blues-drenched. It's more toward the Stan Getz Nightingale kind of thing, I guess you could call it. Very lyrical, although it can turn dark, darker than Stan Getz's sound. The first tune we're going to hear, though, is not dark at all. It's the standard tune called Get Happy, and this is the most bebop-oriented performance on this new album, Don't Explain, which is on the Palmetto label.
Joel Fromm, Get Happy, with Brad Meldow, his high school pal.
Yeah.
Joel Fromm, he's a guy in his 30s, right?
Yeah, Joel Fromm and Brad Meldow, I'm going to guess, are 35 years old.
Yeah,
I know
yeah.
that Brad Meldow was born in 1968, so I'll guess the same.
A lot of music ahead of them. What else have you got?
I've got a tune that is generally taken at an up-tempo clip. It's Sonny Rollins' tune called Olio, which is based on the chord changes of George Gershwin's I've Got Rhythm. But in this case, these two guys give it an eerie, almost dreamlike feel by slowing it down. ¶¶
know, Bill, the thing is, whenever it seems to me a duo album is reviewed, the reviewer will either say or write something like, it sounds like a conversation between two old friends. And this is it.
Yeah.
These are two old friends.
A guy like Joel Fromm, who's still so young, could he attain the stature of the guys we started talking about at the top of our segment, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Lester Young? Verdict's still very much out. I mean, look at his versatility.
Well, honestly, no, because it's such a different world now. Within the jazz realm, he could be a highly respected. He is already. You know, he's on the road a lot of the year with the singer Jane Monheit, and he's recorded a couple of times previous to this new album. But it's such a different jazz world now. It's such a different music world, media world.
Let's hear one more cut from Joel Fromm before we tie it all up.
Well, the last tune I think will be most familiar to most of our listeners. It's a tune that rarely is given jazz interpretation. It's the Beatles song, the pastoral, folkish Beatles song called Mother Nature's Son, on which Joel Fromm plays the soprano saxophone.
From James Isaacs, thanks very much for bringing us a long-lost jazz sax player today on the program, Curtis Amy, and Joel Fromm, a sax player still being discovered, and no doubt with a lot of discoveries himself to make yet as a sax player.
I would say that's very true.
Our jazz aficionado is James Isaacs. For more information on Curtis Amy and Joel Fromm, check out our website at here-now.org. Thanks, James.
My pleasure, Bill. See you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
How will the Democratic presidential candidate spin the results in Iowa?
And promises kept and broken. As we ready for this year's State of the Union address, we look at last year's.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.